From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, the Lost Kingdom. But here's what's happening. Well, if you happen to live in the Panhandle, Oklahoma specifically, listen to this one. Mile for mile, there are almost as many earthquakes rattling Oklahoma as California this year. This major increase in seismic shaking led to a very rare earthquake warning from the U.S. Geological Survey and the Oklahoma Geological Survey. In a joint statement, the agencies are saying the risk of a damaging earthquake, one larger than magnitude 5, has significantly increased in central Oklahoma. Geologists do not know when or where the state's next big earthquake will strike, nor will they put a number on the increased risk. But it is a warning. In Arkansas, some of the April 27th tornado victims may have never had the chance to say goodbye. One young man, however, when fear set in as he waited out the storm in a bathroom, had the chance to send one final message to his mother. It's something that she will never forget and will hold on to forever. First, he said, "Mama, I'm so scared," said Regina Wood. That's Jeffrey Hunter's mother. All Wood could think of was to tell her son Jeffrey, "Hey, you'll be okay." From her home in Beebe, 20 miles from where her son was, Regina could only update Jeffrey through texting on where the EF-4 tornado was headed. It was headed straight for him, and Jeffrey knew it. He was telling his mom goodbye. "I have a text on my phone as the tornado was hitting him. Goodbye, Mama." Jeez, how about that? A U-2 spy plane caused a computer glitch at a California air traffic control center that led officials to halt takeoffs Wednesday. You remember that story? At several airports in the southwestern United States and ground planes bound for the region from other parts of the country. The computer problem at the FAA centers slowed the journeys of tens of thousands of arriving and departing passengers at Los Angeles International Airport, of course, one of the busiest in the country. The Bob Hope Airport in Burbank, California, John Wayne in Santa Ana, California, McCarran International in Las Vegas were among the other facilities affected by the order to keep the planes grounded. The Pentagon could not immediately comment on this, but a U-2 is a Cold War era spy plane used still by the U.S. military. It passed through airspace monitored by the Los Angeles Air Route Traffic Control Center and somehow appeared to have overloaded a computer system at the center. Strange story, isn't it? More than 300 flights, over 3,000 hours in the air, a staggering 4.6 million square kilometers of ocean. The numbers speak to the search for the missing Malaysia Airlines Flight 370. That plane, carrying 239 people, disappeared on March 8th, and despite an expansive search involving 26 countries, nothing to show for it. James Sanders, author of The Downing of TWA Flight 800, wanted us to get through this May 2nd period. That was the third anniversary of killing Osama bin Laden. And James, we have now passed that window. Now what do we do?
Well, that's a good question. There's a couple of things that have popped up recently that are making this a bit more interesting. The Malaysians released the air traffic control recording last week. That recording was given to a, here in the United States, an audio forensic company with literally a thousand cases under its belt in court analyzing this type of thing. And they have concluded that three areas of that tape in the time leading up to it, when it made its turn, 370 made its turn, there are three areas of that that have been altered prior to it being released. And at least in one of those, something different was taped over and inserted. So the plot really thickens.
It sure does.
Then when you look, I went over and read some Malaysian newspapers, and British MI6 is identified as, along with the FBI, But MI6 is identified as being part of this operation over in Malaysia to pick up these 11 alleged terrorists and whatnot. Now, the, you know, the FBI and their DNA, they're news hounds. You know, that's just them. But MI6 in an ongoing investigation?
Strange. Let's keep watching this one, Jim.
Okay.
Thank you, my friend.
Yeah.
Pro-Russian rebels, as we reported, shot down a Ukrainian helicopter in fierce fighting near an eastern town in Ukraine. And Kiev drafted police special forces to the southwestern port city of Odessa to halt a feared westward spread of rebellion. Jerry Corsi from WorldNet Daily, author of Hunting Hitler, continues to monitor this story for us. Jerry, I just have a feeling this is right on the cusp of becoming really something big.
I think, George, in any hour, it could break out into a military invasion by Russia into Ukraine. Clearly, as these eastern pro-Russian groups have strongholds and are surrounded by the Ukrainian military, Russia's going to make sure that the pro-Russian supporters, sympathizers, are not defeated and wiped out by the Ukrainian military. So it's, you know, one of these situations is going to turn into a pretext, a reason for Russia to say, okay, we're going to invade to protect the pro-Russian separatists throughout Ukraine. And the situation gets more dangerous hourly as the rebellion, the pro-Russian rebellion in Ukraine, spreads westward toward Odessa. So, I mean, you've got a situation here that's a tinderbox that I think Russia is just standing on the edge, waiting for the moment when Russia feels like it can get away with a military invasion to support pro-Russian separatists throughout Ukraine.
I had heard that Russian Jews are trying to flee Odessa. Have you heard that?
Yes, there's reports on that coming out of Israel right today. And I think it's a desperate situation. I mean, the Kiev government has had a history of being more anti-Semitic and even pro-Nazi going back to World War II. The Ukraine's a very, very complex situation. And the entire idea of Russia invading Ukraine is so reminiscent of, you know, Hitler's Germany going into Austria and Czechoslovakia to protect pro-German Austrians and Czechoslovakians, that this is the kind of situation that leads one step after another to a regional conflict and possibly even to a world war. It's got to be watched very closely, and now there's reports that the Russian military are doing adventurous moves with the Navy and their Air Force, the Russian Air Force in the Pacific, even sending Russian strategic bombers over Guam, U.S. territories in Guam, and also towards the Pacific West Coast to test U.S. military reactions.
Here we go. Thanks, Jerry. We'll watch this story, too. Never ends. The World Health Organization has declared the spread of polio is an international public health emergency. Jeez, I thought polio was all gone, but apparently not. Outbreaks in Asia, Africa, the Middle East are an extraordinary event needing coordinated international response, according to WHO. It recommends citizens of affected countries traveling abroad carry a vaccination certificate. The WHO has recorded so far 417 cases of polio worldwide for the whole of 2013, but it's already pacing way ahead of that this year. Polio mainly affects children under 5 years of age. A long time ago, in a far-off land, there was a talk show host. His name was Ian Punnett. Ian, of course, left coast to coast because of severe tinnitus, author of a book, How to Pray When You're Beeped at God. And I thought, you know what, be a nice time just to check in with Ian and see how he's doing. How are you, my friend?
Well, first of all, let me just say thank you. I'm doing great. I love listening to this, always to your news at the top of the hour, all the way down to the segment. So it's an honor to be in it, still listening to you all the time, and it's nice to be back on Coast to Coast, if only for a quick visit.
What is Ian Punnett up to these days?
Just wrapping up first year of the PhD program at the Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Communication. I have to finish a paper by Wednesday on the use of shadow self imagery between phenomenologist Immanuel Levinas and Carl Jung.
Well, you should do well with that.
And looking forward to a visit from you coming up, right?
Yeah, I'm coming there in a few weeks, so let's make sure we get together. And, Ian, of course, our door is always open to you.
Well, thank you. I wish the Coyotes were still playing. Glad to see the Kings are still in it.
Oh, Tommy loves it.
If the D-backs were worth going to, we could catch a game, but next time perhaps.
How is your book, How to Pray When You're Beep at Dog doing?
You know what? It's so interesting, and it's sad to think about it, but whenever you have tragedies like what people are facing, this is the kind of thing that they often have to deal with secondarily, is a feeling of not being able to pray because they're experiencing anger toward God. And so that's usually when the emails kick up, or at my Twitter site, which is at Deacon Punnett, that's when I get a lot of emails or tweets from people saying, hey, can you help me get through a situation? And I'm always happy
great.
To help.
And how's the tinnitus, Ian?
That won't get better for a while. But it's okay. You know what? It's just nice not to, I mean, as much as I miss radio and I hear you do it and I hear you do it so well, and I actually hear you do it so well, I think I could never do it that well anyway. And I think to myself, I'm just so glad I don't have to wear headphones every day anymore,
because
that was killing me. Oh. So that part's good. And I hope everybody else out there listening to you who has tinnitus is getting good help and good advice.
Super.
It's a real thing.
I'll see you in a couple weeks, okay?
God bless you, buddy. Looking forward to it.
Ian Punnett. It was April 28th, 2001. I did my first fill-in show. It was a Sunday night. Very first coast-to-coast program. Very first out of St. Louis. And I filled in for Ian. Small world. You know, people across the western New York and Ontario, Canada area have reported seeing extremely bright daylight fireball. Several people caught images of the bright object appearing to explode on dashboard cameras right in front of their eyes in their cars. It happened Sunday. People said the object had a brightness rivaling the sun. Well, could it have been, of course, debris from Halley's Comet? Let's check in with Dr. Sky, Stephen Cates. What do you think that was, Stephen?
Well, George, it's possible, again, talking about this, you never know. It could be part of what we call mankind's comet, better known as Halley's Comet. I'll say it's always possible. But for the entire coast audience, another great meteor shower, folks. If your skies are clear, look to the southeast starting around 3 a.m. And if you see any of these debris, George, as we mentioned before, this is one of the two showers associated with Halley's Comet. The Eta Aquarids, which is what's going on now, discovered around 1870, and then the Orionids in October. And sky watchers can see, with moonless skies and good weather, maybe upwards of 20 of these meteors. But if you missed Halley's in 86 and you don't think you'll be around in 2061, it's a good time to check. But George, very quickly here, I know time is limited. The potential here for a big news event here for the Coast audience. Pay attention, folks, to the night of May 23rd, and 24th, we may get to see, according to astronomers, debris from Comet 209P Linear. If you look to the North Star that night and into the morning of the 24th, all hell could break out from the skies. And we've talked about this before, and hopefully we can talk about it again. For more updates, go to drsky.com and also our aviation site, photorecon.net. And George, like many, I'm hoping to see you and the entire crew when you come to Arizona in just a couple of weeks.
You got it, Stephen. Thank you so much. We'll see you then. Hey, The Amazing Spider-Man 2 has opened at the top of the North American box office. Took in $92 million. Also in Europe, it took in a haul of $116 million. The superhero Sony film enjoyed the second best domestic debut of the year so far, just behind Disney's Captain America, The Winter Soldier. Now, you know, we've talked a lot about the banking system on this program, and who's truly behind the power. In a moment, Nomi Prinz joins me. All the president's bankers next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Special 2 hours as we talk about all the president's bankers, an incredible series of stories that really started a long time ago about truly the power here in the United States. Nomi Prinz, journalist, speaker, television and radio commentator, former Wall Street executive, her most recent book, of course, All the President's Bankers, groundbreaking narrative about the relationships of presidents to key bankers over the past century and how it affects this planet, this country, and all of us. She's currently a senior fellow at the nonpartisan public policy think tank Demos. Nomi, great job on this book, by the way.
Oh, thank you so much, George, and thank you for having me on tonight.
This is a subject that is so dear to our hearts. You know, we've talked about I think we were the first ones to tell the world the Federal Reserve's not part of U.S. government, folks. These are private bankers. They're doing their thing. Tell me about yourself, Nomi. How'd you get involved in this?
Well, I actually was a private banker back in the day.
Okay.
So that started it. Well, that started it first. Yes, I did work on Wall Street for almost a decade, as well as part of that over in London for Bear Stearns. The last place I worked was for Goldman Sachs, and I left that in 2002, right after the Enron scandal broke out, as well as, after 9/11. Mm-hmm. That was a real soul-searching moment for all of us.
Sure was.
And then I went to talk about what was going on inside the industry through writing, through speaking, just to bring knowledge of what I had experienced to the rest of the world. And even in the first book I wrote when I came out of banking back then, Other People's Money in 2004, I spoke about the sort of power concentration of the banks and also how inside Goldman, you know, the key thing to do was to say if you were a senior manager that you had just been in Washington talking to people in Washington. I mean, this was what was going on internally, but it's not until you're outside that you can really, or I could really bring more objective scrutiny and look at the documentation and everything that surrounds the sort of power imbalance where the power is concentrated between the president, the executive branch of the government, and the bankers relative to all of the rest of us.
Nomi, why is it that when we hear the word bankers, people get uptight? I mean, we have car loans, we have mortgages, we borrow from banks, we use credit cards. You would think that there'd be a love affair with people and banks, but there really isn't. How come people are so uptight about that?
Because we know today, and we've known through different periods in our history, particularly when we're in the wake of a financial crisis, that the banks do a lot more than just provide us money for car loans and mortgages and so forth. They basically take the fact that we have deposits with them and that we do use them for these types of life-related circumstances and our own personal economics. And they take that money and they take the fact that they hold it hostage and they use it to influence policy, to influence economies, our economy, as well as in economies globally. And that the people at the top of the banks make an exorbitant amount of money compared to any of their depositors who are paying them interest to do so. So the imbalance that we see and the crookedness and the fraud that comes out of the major institutions is why we have such cynicism. And it's the right place for us to examine the whole structure of finance in this country, because it isn't a fair structure. The laws get written by the banking community, and as I've shown in the book, for the past 100 years, the relationships between bankers and presidents are so connected, are so symbiotic, are so tied by blood and all sorts of other types of relationships, that individuals who just simply use banks are at the bottom rung of this ladder of power and at the bottom rung of a tremendous amount of speculation and risk that when it goes wrong, we support. We support with our tax dollars, we support with whatever we lose throughout the rest of our economic lives, and the individuals at the top of banks just sort of go merrily on and get another $20 million or whatever bonus and
yep.
keep going with the backing of not just the U.S. government, but governments throughout the world. And in our own lives, when we take those kinds of risks and we fail so badly, we don't get the same type of backing. We don't command the same type of power that these institutions, particularly the big six institutions in this country, command today and have commanded throughout the century.
Are these banks that powerful, Nomi?
These banks I go back to something called the Bank Panic of 1907. That was when Teddy Roosevelt was president. And that was a time where a lot of what we have today started, which is there was a big banker, people know the name because it was J.P. Morgan, and now it's on the corner of many, many towns as part of J.P. Morgan Chase. Many people bank with them. It's the largest bank in the country today. But at the time, J.P. Morgan and Teddy Roosevelt were friends. And as friends, as men who trusted each other, who hung out together, who clubbed together in the social club manner mm-hmm. of the day. When the panic happened, it happened because a bunch of people were rigging the copper market. It's always about someone rigging something and it going wrong.
Yeah, somebody getting greedy and then it backfires.
And it backfired against all the individuals who had money in this one trust company called Knickerbocker Trust. And it was creating a panic. It was creating, like, people in the streets wanting to get their money out. At the time, depositors didn't have insurance for their money. If the bank went under, their money went under. That was it. It was gone. So this brought a physical rage in the streets. And Teddy Roosevelt was very afraid of this rage that it could go over and spill into the general economy in the country. So he told his friend, J.P. Morgan, you do something about this. And in the very first instance, of a backing, a bailout, really, of the Treasury Department backing a private bank and saying, you can have this money, you sort it out, you do what you need to do. The Treasury Department allocated $25 million, which was a lot of money back then. First instance of doing this to J.P. Morgan, said, here, you take this money, you figure out how to save the situation.
Hold on for a second, Nomi. I want to get to the story. That's fascinating. Nomi Prinz with us, all the president's bankers on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. We'll take your calls with Nomi Prinz next hour. I know you're interested in the banking situation, all the president's bankers. So, Nomi, J.P. Morgan gets a $25 billion federal bailout at the time. What does he do with the money?
So he takes the $25 million, and he also tells his friends that there's more work to be done. He gets them together in his library, you know, late at night, the whole thing. And what he does with their money as well, of which it also included a bit of Standard Oil money, some Rockefeller money that he had liquidated in order to help save the banking. So it wasn't even really his money, okay? It was J.P. Morgan taking some Treasury money and some other money from his friends who were all sort of powerful and hanging out together. And he says, you know what, I'm going to save not the Knickerbocker Trust Company, which is the one we were talking about where all the people were outside trying to get their money out. No, he did not save that one. He saved something called the Trust Company of America, the point of which is he saved his friend's bank. He saved the bank where he had relationships. He saved the bank where he had investments. And that idea that Teddy Roosevelt said to a private banker, here's some money, you do what you want, you save the system, J.P. Morgan saves not the bank that was in question but another bank, is very, very much a precursor to what we have today, because Teddy Roosevelt was considered a trust buster. He was going to go up against all these industries, and he did, but he never busted the bank. This was a really crucial part of why they have become so powerful. And J.P. Morgan was heralded a king, literally. The New York Times called him a king for saving us when he didn't even do it with his own money.
Wow.
That, however, was a precursor to something you were talking about in the beginning of the hour, which is the Federal Reserve. So J.P. Morgan said, you know what? I'm not even going to have to deal with this stress again. I am going to continue to push to have a central bank in the United States so that when there is a situation like this, again, there's a one stop shopping, one bank that's going to back the banks, and it became the Federal Reserve. So J.P. Morgan sponsored a meeting at a place called Jekyll Island. I went to Jekyll Island. I did a lot of research there and some documents, because a number of people have written about this over the years, but to find out some new things. And what I did discover was, though he was not there, where there were six people who gathered at Jekyll Island, one of which was the Senator who was head of the Finance Committee in Washington, and another guy from Washington, and four bankers. So two guys from Washington, four bankers, all of which was sponsored by J.P. Morgan, because you could not even get on that island into the Jekyll Island Club, which is a very exclusive club at the turn of the century, unless you had membership. None of the six men had membership. Huh. The man who had membership, right, was J.P. Morgan. And that's the way he got in. And I looked at the guest books from back in the time. J.P. Morgan's name, of course, is not on there because he wasn't there, but neither are any of their names. It was really very much secretive, even from the standpoint of how the island itself kept records, which themselves were considered to be secret at the time. So that was what was going on then. The result, long story short, there's a lot of detail in the book of all those shenanigans. I think you also used that word a little bit ago, that happened under the Taft administration, who was the Republican president, when Nelson Aldrich, a senator, went to Jekyll Island with these bankers. And then Woodrow Wilson, who was the Democrat president right after him, who ultimately was the guy who signed the Federal Reserve Act of 1913, which gave the bankers a bank that would protect them in times of panic. And that's really what the Fed was set up to do from the get-go, and it's what continues to be done today.
Nomi, do these bankers want wars?
The thing that happened is that after the Federal Reserve was created, World War I broke out. There was a meeting, and this is where, again, I'm going to throw in J.P. Morgan, but it's one of many, many names in the book, but he was very important, as was his progeny. There's a lot of family ties in this. J.P. Morgan dies, the first one, right? Jack Morgan is his son. He's around. It's World War I about to break up. He has this meeting with Woodrow Wilson in July of 1914. The war broke out in August the next month. And all the press is like, why is there a banker in the White House? Because Woodrow Wilson had campaigned on this notion that he would break up these banks, that he would depower Wall Street because of what had happened in the panic and so forth. And it turned out that the conversation had to do with financing the wars. Morgan, Jack Morgan, actually said the war is a great opportunity for America. This was a direct quote. And at the time, after this meeting with Woodrow Wilson, he comes out. The press wants to know why he's there. He doesn't answer them. He's a very private guy. Woodrow Wilson barely answers them. He just says, I invited him here at my pleasure. Now, Wilson and Morgan, the Morgan family went back a long way as well. Jack Morgan's grandfather, Junius Morgan, had helped fund Woodrow Wilson when he was the president of Princeton University. So, again, all these ties sort of go back
a while. They're all buddies, aren't they?
They're all buddies. And the war was financed. World War I, 75% of the private financing that America put into World War I and for its allies and for war-related activities went through the Morgan Bank. This is not a secret with respect to Washington, because the Morgan partners were in and out of Washington during this entire time. And as a result, also Morgan got a lot of regulations that were being considered against banks to be deconsidered against banks. And fast forward to World War II, the same thing happened. It wasn't just Morgan running 75% of the show. It was also Chase had stepped up as well, as had National City Bank, which we now know as Citigroup and so forth. And they made a lot more money out of World War II because there was a few more banks involved. Still very key ones, still part of the Big Six, which we know today. Back then, they were also part of the Big Six back then. And they also made a lot of money out of the war. Out of World War II, though, they also had the benefit of getting more American customers to open accounts at the same banks that were also issuing war bonds. So in addition to doing private financing and working with the government and opening their doors for people to come in and pay for war bonds so they could consider themselves patriotic and subsidizing the war as well, the bankers were then like, okay, well, you know, why don't you open an account here with us? And so as a result, after World War II, when all was said and done, they had all of these extra depositors consolidated at the biggest banks, because those are the ones who worked most closely with the Treasury Department and with the FDR and Truman administrations to finance the war.
I guess if you're a banker, it was brilliant, wasn't it?
It was brilliant because it actually saved their reputation. In between the two wars, there was the crash of 1929, and all of a sudden bankers were persona non grata everywhere, and everybody remembered that was what had happened in the panic of 07. Now it's 22 years later. There's a war in between. Everybody was unified. Then the crash happens, and all of a sudden people are losing their shirts, their jobs, their homes, their lives. And then World War II happens, and all of a sudden the bankers are patriotic and mm-hmm. and being aligned and supportive. And all of a sudden this idea of unity in the country was something that people migrated towards, and the bankers were sort of lifted up in the eyes of the country. Now, the good thing was they also had to have some accountability to the country, because in between that there were regulations left on them before World War II. But the point is that they really benefited in so many ways, even reputationally, from World War II.
Nomi, President Nixon takes us off the gold standard when he's in office. What does that do for the bankers?
So 30 years after the war, they've all been trying to figure out ways to expand internationally, because now, again, they've consolidated all these additional domestic accounts. They've got money. They want to spend it. They want to expand, as does America as a superpower. But the problem is gold, because if bankers had to reserve something, a hard asset, in their coffers in order to go and speculate, in order to go and lend to other countries, in order to build infrastructure elsewhere, it was harder to do, because the more you have to be accountable, and that's what gold did. Gold held speculation accountable, then the less you can speculate. And so bankers very much pushed Nixon, even though he was the one who made the announcement, the famous announcement in 1971, and took us off of the gold standard. It was really bankers such as Walter Wriston, who was rising in National City Bank again, which is now Citigroup, who pressed him, as did David Rockefeller, to get rid of the gold standard. They had tried this under JFK. They tried this under LBJ. By the time they got to Nixon, they were successful. And what that enabled them to do was to leverage, or basically take the deposits they had and speculate more against them, because they didn't have to also hold gold.
That's right.
Behind them. And that created an era. It's not just speculation, which has culminated in all sorts of crises for us and globally, third world debt crises and so forth. It created this lack of accountability as well. because there was nothing physical to hold these transactions accountable. And then there was nothing moral to hold them accountable either, because there was nothing physical. So it created a whole new era.
It became the fiat currency, I assume.
Exactly. And it's only more so now. And you know, we talked about the Fed a little bit ago, what the Federal Reserve did in tandem with not having a gold standard was allow in future crises for the bankers to have a backstop, for them to have even cheaper money because it could be created more easily because there was nothing that they had to hold against it either, or the banks had to reserve with them either with the Fed. And so this enabled banks to continue to speculate and speculate with less and less accountability financially, again, as well as from a standpoint of caring about what that could do if it went wrong to the population here or abroad.
Did all the banks here have this omnipotent power compared to other banks in other countries, like in Germany or Switzerland?
That's a really good question, George. The thing is, here, because of the ties, because of the family and blood and social connections that went back to the Roosevelt and Morgan families and the different FDR as well. Roosevelt was connected to the Morgans in terms of his personal societal connections. His father, James Roosevelt, had created something called the Metropolitan Club, which was a place where he went with bankers of the day, including J.P. Morgan, to decide the matters of the day. So this was something that in America was much more prevalent in terms of the government and banking policy alignment and ideology alignment and physical friendships and society connections that we had here with respect to what is established in other countries. Because, for example, here, the Rockefeller family, that has been a family that controlled or ran the Chase Manhattan Bank, which is now part of J.P. Morgan Chase, for the better part of 70 to 80 years in the 20th century. So when you have that kind of established family power and legacy power in the hands of an institution that's also quite powerful, and then on the other side you have presidents who not just are made to do something because of the bankers, but openly collaborate with respect to policy and what bankers are telling them because they're on the same page. They're the same people. They're just in two separate offices, really. One's elected and one's appointed, or one's sort of more of a hierarchy or a monarchy in terms of the banking system itself, then you have more power concentrated. And the U.S., with respect to Switzerland or Germany, has that down in a manner that far exceeds the connection of political and financial power and driving policy that there is anywhere else in the world. And it has, and it's accumulated this concentration of political and financial power over that past century.
Noemi, we hear a lot about the Rothschild family, that they may be the planet's richest family. Who the heck are they?
I don't really go back too much into the Rothschild. They were a family that made much of their money in the beginning part of my story, or in the beginning part of what I cover, where the Morgans really took over from the Rothschilds and became the predominant American financier family. But the idea was that
Rothschilds were European, right?
Exactly. And the Rothschilds were European and based in England. And the back historically, when they were powerful, they were a private family, basically in control of private wealth that dictated to a large extent what public policy would be, much the same as the Morgans have done, or the Rockefellers, or the Aldriches, or the Stillmans, or different families have done here, as well as their legacy firms. And that's what they did there. The shift happened when the Federal Reserve was created in the United States, when the Morgan interest was predominating not just the Federal Reserve, but the relationships with Washington, and this major connection on the political financial spectrum happened. So the Rothschilds maintained their richness, and they were certainly rich, and they were involved with a lot of business transactions and financial transactions in particular, also with the Morgans, also with the Rockefellers, also with the Stillmans, with all of the big families at the turn of the 20th century in America. But yeah, today, the way I look at the data and I look at these connections and how they drive political policy as well as financial policy, it really is the American bankers that are at the moment on top of the global heap in terms of concentrated wealth and power that they can inflict on the governments and that governments embrace from then. Because global policy today, this idea of zero interest rates, this idea of this cheap money that has no backing, this idea of subsidizing bank failures by buying their bonds as opposed to letting them fail. All of this is really American-related policy, and that's where that shifted power really came from, Britain to America, from the turn of the last century into through today.
Now, over the past years, from Bush 1 to Clinton to the next Bush to President Obama, what's been going on with the banking situation?
So going on from the getting off of the gold standard and also finding oil, that was the other thing that happened before Reagan came into power, was that in addition to not having to have a reserve asset, bankers also found oil. And so they had less of an incentive, or were less also demanded by the leadership in Washington to help the country. They went off on their own. They found this other source of profitability and recycling, what it was called, petrodollars, or money that was made from profitability of oil in the Middle East, into loans throughout the world, including through Latin America in particular. That resulted, because they dumped so much money into Latin America, and they also cooked a lot of their books at the time, because accounting was even looser at the time and there was less computer systems to even fiddle with. A lot of the books were very, very manipulated at the time, which I show. But Latin America ultimately imploded, because if you have too much debt thrown at you and it's at ludicrous prices, if the bank's making money, that doesn't mean the country's going to make money, and that's what happened. That was the first instance in decades of a big bailout by the government. And under the Reagan administration, and in particular, Treasury Secretary Don Regan, who was the CEO of Merrill Lynch. Merrill Lynch is now part of Bank of America, which is one of today's big six banks, and a task force with the first Bush, because Regan and Bush were friends. And the Bush family goes back to Merrill Lynch to the early part of the 1900s as well. Mm-hmm. Merrill Lynch had kind of taken a bunch of the George Walker Bush, who had an investment bank in 1902, and that became ultimately part of Merrill Lynch, which became part of Bank of America. So there was a big tie, again, over a century, the Bushes and banking and the idea of deregulating banking, because that would allow more of this expansion internationally in different ways. And so what was happening in Washington was two things. One is that the bankers were pushing the government to bail them out of the third world debt crisis that they had created, and they succeeded in doing that. And simultaneously, they were trying to push for the administrations of Reagan and Bush to get rid of regulations that would keep more speculative activity out of the hands of single institutions, of single banks like Bank of America or what has now become Citigroup or Chase at the time. So they were pushing on two fronts. They were saying, look, we've just screwed up in the, you know, this whole Middle East, Latin America thing, so bail us out of that. And by the way, we also want to have less rules going forward. And this worked in Washington. Bush's task force, and I went and I read through these, like, tons of documents and these reports he would send to Reagan, who wasn't really that involved with banking stuff. It was mostly delegated to Bush, and then ultimately to his Treasury Secretary, too, who was a banker, Nicholas Brady, who was involved in helping with the bailout of the Latin American debt crisis of the banks. And so all this deregulation was happening in little bits and steps along the Reagan administration and the Bush first administration. By the time he got to Clinton, the same individuals who were involved in pushing this deregulation, this idea that you could bail out problem banks, particularly if they were big and they were your friends, in shades of the J.P. Morgan, Teddy Roosevelt situation mm-hmm. in 1907, it's all the same, that this would continue as a policy. And so Robert Rubin, who was the co-CEO of Goldman Sachs, became the Treasury Secretary of Clinton. So now you have several Treasury Secretaries in a row who came from Wall Street, and they all say exactly the same thing. It doesn't matter if it's under a Republican president or a Democratic president. It completely doesn't matter. Money doesn't care about political party. It was just the question of, let's continue to deregulate. And what happened was the mantra for doing so, which was the same under these three presidents, was we need to do this because this is for the good of American competitiveness. America as a country cannot be competitive in the world unless we have a free, deregulated banking system, meaning that the concentration of power and wealth will go to the largest bank.
Naomi, we're going to take this break. We're going to come back. We'll talk more about this. I also want to ask you about the Bank of Credit and Commerce. You remember that, BCCI. And then you also talk about the Iranian hostage situation and that couple bankers may have been responsible for that. We'll talk about that, and we'll take phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM.